This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, welcome to the program. I'm Cassie Huff, and today we're talking access to ports. Getting grain to port on the Eyre Peninsula has been a long-standing issue, particularly with the closure of the rail lines as well recently. But a few port proposals are on the EP now. They're on the cards, and we're just going to look at how they stack up.
We already have close to 1.5 million tonne of excess belt capacity on the Eyre Peninsula to load ships. So that's meaning that for almost 50% of the time, what we have now is not working, which to me is very inefficient. So somebody comes along, offers to build an extra 1 million tonne of belt capacity as a grain-only port, it's just not adding up.
And we're going to take an in-depth look at this issue, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on whether you think a port or more ports are needed. You can text in on 0467 922 891, or you can call in on 1300 222 891. We're also going to be taking a look at subsidies. Do you think that farmers need more subsidies? The government's agricultural forecaster is going to weigh in on how useful they've been to Australian farmers. But as I was saying, there is concerns being raised once again about a port development near Lipsom Cove, about 10 kilometres from Tumby Bay. The grains-only port, known as Port Spencer, is being developed by Free Eyre and Peninsula Ports. But does the region need a grain-only port to go ahead? A petition was started, which has close to 2,500 signatures, and some Free Eyre shareholders have said they don't want to be involved. Farmer and president of the Tumby Bay Progress Association, Dean LeBrun, says that there has been a groundswell of opposition once again to the grain-only port going ahead.
I think because of the Peninsula Ports, you know, media blitz they've been having about how well they're travelling, and, you know, constantly for the last few months, it's next month we're starting, next month we're starting, next month we're starting. So, you know, that sort of made people think, well, hang on, this is real, this is potentially happening, and now they've worked out exactly where it is. And they're sort of saying, well, this is a bit crazy. There's another port proposal less than 10 kilometres north of Lipsom Cove, which is to the community a much more acceptable compromise, and they're saying, well, why can't we just have that instead of changing what we enjoy at Lipsom Cove?
Dan, we're often hearing about farmers wanting more competition, so why would this not be a suitable option for farmers on the EP?
Well, that's something that I've struggled to get my head around for a long time in all of this, Brooke. I mean, the simple thing is you think more export ports, more competition, but then you give it a little bit more thought and you think, well, this is not bringing a new marketer, a new grain buyer to our table. It's not delivering a cargo to a new market which isn't already serviced by the existing potentially four grain export ports off of Eyre Peninsula. It's providing an extra outlet for what we already have. So that's really not giving us any new markets, any new buyers than what we already have. And, you know, honestly, any port has to have a buyer actively posting forward prices for growers to take contracts delivered to that port for it to work. And, you know, Lucky Bay managed to achieve that with Archer Daniels Midland coming on board. I haven't seen any major buyer jump on board with the Port Spencer, Lipsom Cove, Rogers Beach development.
Is there enough grain on the EP to service all these ports?
Well, that's another thing that I've been thinking about, and I've sort of looked into it. We already have close to 1.5 million tonne of excess belt capacity on the Eyre Peninsula to load ships. So that's meaning that for almost 50% of the time, what we have now is not working, which to me is very inefficient. So somebody comes along, offers to build an extra 1 million tonne of belt capacity as a grain-only port, it's just not adding up. I mean, it's extra capacity, which to my mind is extra inefficiency, which, you know, everyone knows inefficient's not the way to make money.
Just recently, or a couple of months ago, you organised a meeting of grain growers across the EP to get a bit of an idea of where the support sat for different ports on the EP. What was your impression of the support for the one at Lipson Cove with Peninsula Ports, but also the support for the one at Cape Hardy.
It was a very clear message from that meeting. I mean, I went into it with a relatively open mind. I wanted to find out what other growers on the peninsula thought. So the very, very strong message that came out of that was that very, very few grain growers on the Eyre Peninsula, and remember that meeting had people from Sojourner across to Kimber and all the way south, so it was 200 growers from right across the peninsula there. Overwhelmingly, they said, we don't support a grain-only port. We do support the concept of a multi-commodity port for the flow-on economic benefits that new industries could bring to the Eyre Peninsula, and maybe with containerisation, that will give us new grain marketing opportunities and new buyers, give us the option to maybe paddock to end user market our own grain, all that sort of thing. And probably what was the most damning thing that came out of that Cummins meeting was the sheer number of Free Eyre shareholders who got up and said, we don't want this to happen. We are the shareholders of this company. We own it, but we don't particularly want it. So it just makes you question what's going on here.
Tumby Bay farmer and president of the Tumby Bay Progress Association, Dion LeBrun. One of those shareholders is Cummins farmer Fiona Darlitz, who's been a shareholder with Free Eyre since the beginning and has tried to sell back her shares in the past. She made a Facebook post this week to see if anyone was interested in buying her shares, and she got quite a lot of reaction.
So I decided to see what type of response I'd get by putting on one of the buy, swap and sells EP farm machinery, offered to sell my shares. Because as I said, we're no longer interested. We don't think they're doing the right thing at the moment. And I had quite a few responses of people telling me that if I sold mine, to let them know because they want to sell theirs as well.
So what do you think it is that people are wanting to get rid of these shares?
I think we've actually lost trust in this company, and it's the way they're going about it. Like, you know, they started up the Tarragora grain site that failed a few years ago. I personally feel they're not going down the right channels. I can't work out why is there office in Adelaide when they're meant to be here for Eyre Peninsula. You know, there's a lot of empty buildings in rural communities like Lock, Tumby Bay, Cummins. You know, there's lots of empty buildings. They could have them all over here. With this port that they're going ahead and doing, they haven't actually consulted the shareholders as such and asked their full opinion on it. Yes, they did have their AGM last year. And when did they pull it? In December, middle of harvest. So, you know, a lot of us farmers couldn't go to that. So I just don't think they're actually going down the right path. And when you speak to people, they're not impressed, they're not happy, they don't want their shares anymore, and they just don't want this port to happen.
Speaking of the port, what's your reaction to what people would like to see on the EP?
Well, I went to the meeting in Cummins back in March, and from that meeting, the outcome was, yes, there is interest in having another port, possibly on Eyre Peninsula, but for the Free Eyre port, which is just a single commodity, like just a straight grain port, we just don't see the benefits. You know, the other port that they're talking about, you know, 10 k's north at Cape Hardy, that's a multi-commodity port. To me, it's a better site, it's a better idea. Yeah, and just free shareholders, we're just not happy that we haven't been consulted properly. We haven't been given a chance. We haven't been able to vote on it.
Have you spoken to Free Eyre about wanting to get rid of your shares?
Yes, we have. I sent them an email back to probably about 8 years ago, 6-8 years ago. Sent an email offering my shares to them. I got a lovely formal political email back stating that they're not registered and they can't buy our shares. And yeah, and then I said to them, I no longer want further response, like emails and that, but I still get their emails and they don't listen to what the farmers actually want. And we are the shareholders, which we make the company.
Would you approach them again to offer the shares back?
Yes, I would like to approach them again. I'm actually going to see if I can get hold of the Constitution because I'd like to see where in the Constitution it would state that I believe we should be able to call a special general meeting for all shareholders to attend at a decent time and that we can all have our say. So then Free Eyre actually can understand that we're not in favour. There's a lot of farmers that are not in favour.
Cummins farmer Fiona Darlitz. Peninsula Ports is the arm of Free Eyre looking to build the new grain-only port. Chairman John Crosby says he has seen the petition, which has been shared on Facebook, and says the position between Rogers Beach and Lipson Cove meant they would not interfere with either beach. And he says he's hopeful some construction could begin in June. He says he also believes the port does have enough support for it to be viable.
Well, we understand that there are a number of people in that live in that general area that are quite emotional about the beaches that they've used for a very long period of time. And we can assure those people that we are not going to interfere in any way with their use of the beaches.
How can you assure them this?
Because we're not having any interaction with those beaches. The wharf goes straight out from a headland and there will be no impact on the beaches.
Some of the comments that I've seen on Facebook is that people in the area feel they might have been misled by the name of the site. Naming it Port Spencer, was there a reason behind this?
Well, the name Port Spencer was actually chosen by Centrex about 10 years ago. We've just adopted the name because it was on all the documents that we signed. I mean, I think the really important thing to understand about what we're talking about here is that this is a natural place to develop an enterprise on Eyre Peninsula, which is going to be very beneficial to farmers and also very beneficial to the people that live in the area, particularly the town of Thumby Bay. It's a very positive step for that whole area.
Will this provide extra competition with extra buyers of grain coming through this port?
Yes, we believe that there would be much more pointed competition, if I can put it that way, for grain from Eyre Peninsula growers.
Is there enough grain on the EP for just a grain-only port?
Yes, there is about 2.6 million tonnes of grain on Eyre Peninsula in an average season. Obviously, it varies either side of that. All of our calculations have been done on tonnages where there is a freight advantage for us against every other port. Now, that doesn't mean we won't get grain from areas that have got a freight advantage to somewhere else, but what it means is that there is a really good reason why some farmers would want to use this port rather than any other.
John, I've spoken with a lot of the current Free Eyre shareholders, particularly the farmer shareholders. A lot of them feel frustrated that they haven't been asked what they would like to see. Where do you sit with how the consultation has gone with farmers, and do you think that there has been enough?
We do accept that there's been a group of people that don't believe they've been consulted sufficiently. However, we would make the point that we've got a grower advisory group which reports to the board, which has, you know, significant representation from the farmers of Eyre Peninsula. We've had something like 11 meetings with farmers prior to Christmas, and we've had three, I think, might be four, but it's certainly three community meetings around Thumby Bay, and we've tried to talk to everybody that we can talk to. However, if people don't think we've done enough communication, then it's our responsibility to make sure that people know what we're doing, the fact that it is going to be a major advantage to Eyre Peninsula, and that we expect, you know, most people to do quite well out of it.
Prior to Christmas, obviously a busy time for a lot of farmers. Would you consider holding another special general meeting, which has been suggested, with all the growers and potentially maybe having a vote and seeing where people sit?
The position we're in today is that we are awaiting ministerial approval, and we've so far advanced now that we really can't change course. And so I don't see a lot of point. We're very happy to talk to people. We're very happy and will be holding meetings on Eyre Peninsula to properly help people to understand what we're doing and how we're going about it and the various things that we're doing which will be of advantage to not only the people of Eyre Peninsula but also to the general requirements that we are meeting will be beneficial to a whole series of things. For instance, we've agreed to do some research on whale movements as part of what we're doing. We've also agreed with the Bungala to work with them on heritage issues and try to be a good citizen for the area.
John, I guess people, if they haven't felt like they have been consulted, how do you feel that you will get the support if this port does go ahead with grain coming through? Someone suggested that Tarragora, which was another project with Free Eyre, being described as a white elephant, is there chances that this port could go ahead and not be used?
Oh, look, we've got commitments from growers that underwrite the amount of grain that we need to make the port quite profitable.
John, I've spoken to a shareholder who said that they put up a post wanting to sell their shares on Facebook, and there has been a lot of response of others wanting to sell their shares. Where does Free Eyre sit with buying shares back, or is that something that concerns you, that people are wanting to get out?
Well, firstly, I'm not aware of that. There is a procedure. This is an unlisted public company. The procedure for selling shares is to notify the secretariat, and the secretariat will do what they can to find a buyer. That's the procedure. Putting them on Facebook really isn't a sale mechanism that we could condone.
Is it a concern, though, that there are a lot that don't want to be a part of Free Eyre anymore?
If that were the case, we would have a number of people ringing us, and we're not. I've had one inquiry in the last 6 months, and that person, after we'd spoken, was quite happy to hang on to his shares. So I think that's more talk and emotion out there than it is actual fact.
Chairman of Peninsula Ports, John Crosby, speaking to Brooke Nindorf there about concerns about the Port Spencer development on the Eyre Peninsula. Speaking about efficiency in agriculture, a new report from the Australian Bureau of Agricultural and Research Resource Economics and Sciences has concluded that deregulation and the removal of subsidies in agriculture has actually led to a boost in farm income. It confirms the widely held understanding that Australian farmers are among the least subsidised in the world. Jared Greenville is the head of forecasting and trade at ABARES, and he says the report was commissioned in light of these export restrictions and increased government support during COVID-19.
So we wanted to take a bit of a look at where agricultural support policies were targeted and where they're at, really. Coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic, we've seen a few countries implement some policies around export restrictions, increasing levels of, you know, support for farmers in relation to the economic damage that the COVID-19 pandemic has been causing. So we just really wanted to take a bit of a stock take of where things were at to put that into context.
And what did you find?
So we found that, well, starting at home, that Australian farmers are some of the least subsidised in the world.
And that's really confirming what a lot of people already sort of assumed?
Yeah, it is. It's confirming what people assumed and what and the lived experience of our producers, really, that that in terms of, you know, subsidies provided by the government, there's very little in Australia. And it's really only New Zealand that has lower levels out of the countries that OECD measures.
So having sort of concluded that Australian farmers are among the least subsidised in the world, what did you go on to conclude about whether that's good or bad?
So it's been this shift towards low subsidies has really been beneficial for the sector. Australia hasn't always had very low subsidy levels, but as we've reformed our sector in line with, you know, national competition policy and a number of other pro-competitive reforms, the agriculture sector has really kicked off. In aggregate, and we've seen increases in exports, increasing in farmer income overall as an aggregate. Obviously, there's a shift in what we produce and sometimes where we produce certain things, but it's been largely beneficial for the sector.
So why has that happened? Why have less subsidies, deregulation of the industry actually promoted growth?
So a couple of reasons. The first is it just allows resources and, you know, land and capital and the rest to be used where you can get the greatest return for it. The other aspect is that it's opened doors in international markets. Having no subsidies and very low support levels means that Australia has market access to a much larger market. And with 70% of our produce exported and over half our workforce really dependent on trade, we really need to have that access. And this means that what we produce is in line with what our overseas consumers want, and it gives us the best opportunity to access their markets.
And on the other side of the coin, did you study countries that do have significant subsidies where those subsidies are limiting growth?
Yeah, so what some of the evidence that's out there points to is that the countries that do provide large amounts of subsidies, effectively the agriculture sectors are pretty slow growing. Farmer incomes are much lower in terms of the way that they grow, and the sectors are ultimately much more inward focused and into the domestic economy.
And given all of that, though, Australian farmers do still receive some concessions. Farm management deposits, for example, as a way of managing tax. Do you think those still have a role to play?
Yeah, certainly. So Australia still does provide a little bit of support. So the number the OECD comes up with is about 2% of farmer revenues, and that's in the sense of either money they receive or things they don't have to pay for. Biggest part of that is, yeah, farm management deposit, income tax smoothing, and that's really about managing our uniquely variable climate. I mean, we have a climate that's much more variable than anywhere else in the world. And the OECD also acknowledges that and says, you know, puts them in a bucket that they call less distorting measures. They're not directly linked to what you produce, whether it's, you know, beef or milk or grains. And there's much smaller amounts of those subsidies that do have a more distorting impact on what you produce in markets and trade.
So returning to where we began, Jared, you mentioned this potential sort of creeping protectionism after coronavirus. What would be your warning around that?
Well, that's the risk. So what we saw at the back of the global financial crisis, and this is not just in agriculture, but everywhere, but for agriculture, is that the path that we're on of falling levels of global subsidies and distorting policies in agriculture really stalled, and they started to uptick in recent years. Now, the risk is that this, following the COVID-19 pandemic and some of the moves that have been put into place, these things stick around and they go on to have, you know, create further distortions in markets. So there really needs to be, you know, the international rules system in place that allows, you know, governments to do what they need to support their agriculture sectors, but in a way that doesn't really negatively affect producers in other countries.
That was Jared Greenville, Head of Forecasting and Trade at ABARES, speaking to Angus Verley. We'll head across to the Bureau of Meteorology now, where we're joined by Senior Forecaster Simon Timke. Hi, Simon.
G'day, Cathy.
It's a beautiful clear day out there, but it is the calm before the storm. What's happening?
You've summed it up nicely there. It's a ripper outside at the moment. Looking on the latest satellite picture, there's barely a cloud over the state, just a little bit in the far northwest, a little bit near the border in the southeast. So mostly sunny conditions right across the state. Winds generally northerly, and there's a little bit of freshness in them out over the west. But yeah, as you say, a pretty pleasant day. But there is a significant vigorous cold front moving across the west and the south during Saturday, expected to reach the far southwest late Saturday morning and almost reach Adelaide by late Saturday evening. We'll see strong and gusty northerly winds develop ahead of that change. Possibly even raising a little bit of dust over places where there hasn't been much rain yet. So particularly parts of the pastoral district, northern agricultural area, chance of seeing a little bit of dust. And then we'll see some showers develop from the west as that front approaches. So we're forecasting generally just a showers developing in the far west early Saturday morning, then extending eastwards, reaching central districts during the afternoon, eastern districts late afternoon or evening. So a slight to medium chance over the pastoral districts, grading to a high to very high chance over the agricultural area. Chance there could be a thunderstorm near southern and western coasts in the afternoon and evening as well. So conditions becoming cooler behind the change, so milder conditions ahead of the change, and then becoming cooler behind the change. There's another front moving across on Sunday too. It'll reach the west coast late Sunday evening, so we'll sort of see a bit of an easing of the shower activity during the day on Sunday, and then redeveloping Sunday evening and overnight into Monday. So again, a high to very high chance of showers, but most likely early morning Sunday, and then again in the evening as that next front moves across. And for Monday, we'll see generally a high to very high chance of showers over the agricultural area in the southwesterly airstream following Sunday's front. But the showers not reaching too far north, just a slight chance of showers reaching the far south of the pastoral districts on Monday. And then through the middle part of next week, showers and the winds gradually easing as the next high pressure system pushes in. So most significant weather over the next week during that Saturday to Monday period. As far as the rainfall totals go for that four-day period out to midnight Tuesday, generally expecting the order of 2 to 5 millimetres in the far south of the pastoral districts, increasing to 2 to 10 millimetres over the northern agricultural area, 10 to 20 millimetres about the southern agricultural area, and reaching 20 to 35 millimetres about the Mount Lofty Ranges, Kangaroo Island, the lower southeast district, and near remaining southern coasts. Further north, less than 2 millimetres generally, but probably nothing. If you can imagine a line northeast of about Broken Hill to the right up to the northwest corner of the state, probably nothing northeast of that line. So little bit of wintry weather on the way for the weekend, Cassie.
Thanks for that, Simon. And that's the area that really needs it as much as everyone needs it. We really need to get it up to those northern areas, so hopefully more comes for them. in the lower western region of the New South Wales, the it'll be mostly sunny with some showers near the Victorian border. Temperatures will go down to 6 degrees, but reach the low 20s, and pretty similar for the upper western as well, with a low of 7 degrees getting up to the low 20s.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff. Cassie Huff.
Hi, I am Cassie Huff. It's great to have your company on the program today. Now, I'm wondering, have you been getting your green thumb on during coronavirus restrictions? My broccolini is growing beautifully. I'm not far away from being able to harvest it. I've never grown it before. It's quite an interesting crop to grow. But I am only going to eat my vegetables, but part of me wishes I'd put in a pumpkin, because in the Mount Gambier Farmers Market, they are holding their giant pumpkin competition, but it will be online this year. Organisers, though, are pretty confident, though, that people will still stick to a good, clean comp.
I'm just going to trust that, you know, anyone who's in a pumpkin competition is just inherently in it for the love of pumpkin growing, and they're just going to run a good, clean game. And I'm hoping, actually, because of COVID restrictions, people have had more time to just finish off those pumpkins really well.
Have you tried to grow a fruit or vegetable as large as you can, maybe even a pumpkin that you want to enter into the Mount Gambier competition? I'd be interested to hear what you've grown and how successful it's been. You can text in on 0467 922 891, or you can call 1300 222 891. Also this half hour, we're going to look at some research into protecting the threatened mallee fowl. That's up soon, but first we'll find out what's making news headlines with Wendy Glamachak. Hi, Wendy.
Hello, Cassie. The emergency services levy will be increased by about 5% next financial year. Treasurer Rob Lucas says the decision's been made in the wake of a $20 million budget hit from last summer's bushfires and to account for an agreed pay rise for MFS firefighters. Australian mining giant Fortescue Metals Group has lost its bid to appeal against a native title determination over one of its West Australian iron ore mines. The company was seeking to contest the exclusive possession rights of the Yindjibarndi people over the land in the Pilbara that includes the site of its multi-billion dollar Solomon mine hub. Today's High Court decision paves the way for the Yindjibarndi Aboriginal Corporation to pursue what's expected to be a multi-million dollar compensation payout for both economic loss and spiritual harm. And the Tasting Australia Festival's been shelved for this year, but it will return in 2021. Organisers say that with the ongoing uncertainty over mass gatherings and restrictions on national and international travel, the event will now be held in late April next year. More ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks so much for that, Wendy. Now, there's been a lot of talk about vaccines lately, with scientists across the world looking for a vaccine for COVID-19. But there's another highly contagious virus that's deadly to pigs, and it is also spreading across the globe quickly as well. African swine fever has killed hundreds of millions of pigs worldwide, and it is a major threat to Australia's pork industry. We know that there's been border measures that have been put in place to keep it from getting to Australia, but it has been found in Papua New Guinea, and reports are saying India now as well. But there is some good news when it comes to the hunt for a vaccine. Scientists in the UK believe they're a step closer to finding a vaccine for African swine fever after a successful trial. The Purbright Institute is one of several teams that are racing to develop a vaccine for the disease. Lead scientist Dr. Chris Netherton explains the trial to Dan Fitzgerald.
We managed to get 100%, or 6 out of 6 pigs to survive after challenge with a virulent strain of ASF. So this would normally kill the pigs, but although our animals got sick, they recovered. All of them recovered, and that's a pretty good going for this type of vaccine. That's the first time that somebody has managed to get such a good percentage of recovery with a subunit type of vaccine.
Can you explain a little bit more about what this type of vaccine is?
So there's basically at the moment, people are trying to take two different approaches to making an African swine fever vaccine. The first one is a what we call a live attenuated virus vaccine. And this is where you try and identify parts of the virus that are important for its lethality, i.e. ones that make it such a nasty disease. And then you target those sections of the virus, delete those bits, and hopefully this weakens the virus, which means that if you were to administer it to pigs, they won't get sick. And if they encounter the real virulent strain of the virus, then they will have an immune response and they'll be protected against it. The other approach, which is the one that this study was all about, was rather than starting with African swine fever, is to try and identify the individual parts of the virus that cause that immune response, and then you deliver them to the pigs entirely separate from African swine fever, so there's a much better safety profile there, and then see if they, again, these individual components of the virus will actually protect against the disease.
So what's the advantage of this type of vaccine, this vectored vaccine?
So the vector vaccines, the subunit vaccine, should have a much better safety profile. So the problems in the past with the live attenuated viruses is that they've caused a chronic form of disease, or there's the danger of reversion to virulence. Now, fortunately, the viruses that have been tried at the moment haven't really shown this chronic form of disease. There's another disadvantage to live attenuated virus vaccines, and if you were to use them, you need to be able to distinguish the vaccinated animals from ones that have actually naturally come into contact with the virus. So if you were to want to re-establish trade with other countries, you'd obviously want to prove that you're free of virus. And this is what we call differentiate infected from vaccinated animals. And at the moment, the live attenuated viruses don't fit that bill. So this is one big advantage with the subunit vaccines. Very easy to distinguish the animals that have been vaccinated and the ones that have become infected. And they also have a very excellent safety profile, which is obviously one of the key selling points. The vaccines themselves won't cause any problems in the pigs at all. The issue has always been their actual protective efficiency, so how well they protect animals from disease. And that's why this study is such a big step forward, in the sense that we got very good protection after challenge.
The vaccine was pretty successful in this small trial. What's the next step in its development?
So, although the animals, the animals all survived, they still got sick. So we really need to improve the vaccine to make so that those animals don't get sick, because obviously you want your vaccine to work as well as it possibly can. One of the other things that we found was that the animals, although they appeared perfectly healthy, they still had virus in their system. So we want to, by improving the vaccine, we hope that, one, they won't get sick, and two, this residual virus will disappear. And finally, one thing that we do need to check is there are lots of different strains of African swine fever, and we only know that this vaccine protects against one particular strain. So we would need to see if it can have a similar effect against other strains of African swine fever.
What will it take to get this vaccine into commercial production?
A fair bit more research, I think. We're still looking at several years before I think it will be available for farmers. It's still at a pretty early stage.
That was Dr. Chris Netherton, the lead scientist working on an African swine fever vaccine at the Pirbright Institute. Now, this vaccine, as he said, will take several years, but it really can't come soon enough for Australian pork producers. So far, Australia's been able to keep the virus out of the country, but it does pose a major risk to the Australian pork industry. Australian Pork Limited CEO Margot Andre joins me. Hi, Margot.
Morning, Cassie. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How promising is this trial?
Yeah, look, we're very excited to see the results of this. As you said, the African swine fever has wiped out 25% of the global pork production, and it's an animal welfare as opposed to a human welfare issue. But the pigs, you know, it's an awful disease for them to get. So if this works, it's wonderful, great step forward, and it means that producers will be able to confidently rebuild those pig herds around the world.
Are there any Australian scientists working on this as well, or is it largely being done more in the countries that are affected?
Yeah, look, we've got scientists in Australia certainly contributing to a number of different programs around the world. It's always been seen that a global approach is the best way to solve a vaccine issue here. The only thing is, as we said, you know, it's probably 2 years before we could get it into farms. So our best defence is to actually keep it out of Australia, and that's where our focus as producers is at the moment.
This is a bit of a question without notice, but I know there's been a lot of work at the borders. We don't have many people coming and going, so there probably hasn't been much of a ramp up. But are pork products with ASF being found at the borders at all?
Yeah, so it's been continuing to be found, and the reason is that mostly in the packages being sent from overseas. So we're still seeing people continue to send pork products through the mail. And luckily for us, the government did put in programs to protect that through the scanners in Melbourne and Sydney to stop those products. So we are detecting a lot more. But even, you know, this year we've had 11 people sent home for bringing pork products in their luggage. So the message still isn't getting through. So yes, we are a little bit better off. And what it did mean also on the farm, the biosecurity practices we had in place, we literally just stepped them up to go to the next level for COVID. So we're already protecting the animals, and now we've stepped up to protect the people. But yeah, look, we do need people to listen, to not send pork products in the mail. And when travel does resume, please don't bring them in your luggage.
Yeah, the pork industry would be one of the best placed industries given the amount of work that has gone in biosecurity in recent years in pork businesses. But speaking of COVID-19, every food production system has had some sort of impact, whether it's been an increase or decrease. What has COVID-19 restrictions meant for the pork industry?
Yeah, look, we're quite a sensitive industry. It's not like you can sort of just turn the tap off on the production. So it's not like you can stop the pigs coming through the chain into the restaurants and into the exports. So initially losing our exports just for a minor time had a big impact, but we managed to work with governments both here and overseas to get that back and running. But the issue really is the loss of food service. So that's about 26% of our production goes into food service, and having that tap turned off has a big impact, especially for smaller producers who had niche products going into those restaurants. And it was more the premium products as well, your pork bellies, your ribs, that attract the higher premium. And given that producers were just recovering from a couple of tough years, it kind of was a blow they weren't prepared for. So we're seeing a lot of product redirected into other avenues or going into freezers. So it's having a big economic impact on producers now. But our best approach is to work with the food service as they reopen and make sure that pork's pride of place on all of those menus.
Do you think it will be? Is there much pork products being sought out by restaurants?
Yeah, so, well, we're being proactive. We're actually going and working with the restaurants. We've worked really closely with the restaurants through COVID and supported them to have what we call the HOSPO program, which we worked with restaurants to actually cook pork meals for hospitality workers who had lost their jobs and had no income. So they were provided free meals in capital cities. And so what we've done is taken that program to the next step and working with restaurants as they reopen to actually have pork available for them. And the plan is to actually, if they had one dish, they might now have two. If they didn't have pork on the menu, we'll work with them to try and get pork on the menu as they recover. So trying hard to make it. But the other thing we did is more people had pork in their fridge and freezers. So our pork.com.au website has a plethora of recipes for people, everything from a 10-minute meal to a gourmet pork belly feast they can make at home. So we're hoping people are learning not only how to cook our product, but how delicious it is. And it's a great part of a nutritious diet.
Thank you so much for joining us, and I'm sure that the pork industry will be well placed to help other industries as they ramp up from the coronavirus restrictions, given how much effort your industry has put into those biosecurity measures. So thanks for joining me today, Margot.
Thank you.
That was Australian Pork Limited CEO Margot Andre speaking there about the vaccine that's being developed. It's not ready yet, won't be for a couple of years, but hopefully there will be one to protect pigs from the deadly African swine fever and indeed get the industry back operating as we need all of the Australian industries to do. I'm Cassie Huff. It is 16 minutes to one.
This week on Landline, say cheese. how two distributors helped cheesemakers recover first from fires, then coronavirus.
Our cheesemakers all of a sudden started to scream out to us. And, it's hard for so many people.
And protecting Tasmania's precious waterways from livestock. That's Landline 12:30 Sunday on ABC TV.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
The mallee fowl is such an iconic South Australian bird, and there's a long-term monitoring program being done in the Mallee and Riverland to protect the iconic bird. And some of this research has shown that foxes and other predators might not be the only reason why the iconic bird is in decline. Data from monitoring cameras have shown that there was higher mallee fowl breeding activity in areas with more foxes. It seems counterintuitive, but NRM senior ecologist Craig Gillespie says it means that there are other factors affecting the bird's numbers, and conservation efforts should be updated to reflect this.
Well, the idea of the experiment is to investigate the relationship between predators and mallee fowl breeding activity. We measure breeding activity for mallee fowl because they're so sneaky and hard to find that you can't actually just go out and count them. We use the proportion of active nest mounds as an indicator of how well their populations are doing. Now, we tend to associate foxes and cats with the decline in mallee fowl populations because, as we know, they are susceptible to predators. And so we use fox baiting practices to control foxes across the country. But we really don't understand well, believe it or not, the relationship between fox control and fox activity and fox activity and mallee fowl breeding activity. And so we want to understand that better so that we can make sure that the actions that we're doing for mallee fowl conservation are actually hitting the mark and getting results for the threatened bird.
And it is known, obviously, you know, that their population is in decline. That's why all these conservation efforts are happening. But at what kind of rate is this happening, Craig, and why is there so much of a focus on this bird?
Mallee fowl are just a suite of threatened mallee birds that we're working on. They are, of course, a cultural icon in the Mallee, the Mallee farmer. Everybody's got a story about mallee fowl on their property, and the local community is really endeared to them. They are in a state of decline. It's a slow but steady decline. We think that the deepest part of their decline obviously happened decades ago when there was wholesale clearance of their habitat for farming. Obviously, if there's less habitat, then there can be less mallee fowl.
And I guess, your experiment is part of finding out what else is impacting that population decline. So you've set up some cameras. Tell us about them, where they're located, and how they sort of work in helping with this.
So the cameras take care of the measuring the fox activity or predator activity part of the experiment. We also measure, as I said before, we count the proportion of nest mounds that are active each year. And so in some of the sites where we do those counts, we've set up cameras in the local area associated with those mounds, those nesting areas. We don't point the cameras directly at the mounds because we want the background level of activity of predators. We don't want the level of activity of predators that are visiting the mounds because that would skew our result. So there's about 8 cameras set up across 6 different sites between the southern Mallee around Pinneroo and Lamoureux all the way up to Dangali Wilderness Protection Area in the north.
And how long have they been in place for, and how long will they continue to be?
We've set the first cameras up in about in the spring of 2016. So we're coming up to 4 years worth of data now that's been collected from those cameras. And essentially, the experiment is intended to run across the long term. We've been monitoring the nest mound activity for close to 30 years now across the country, and that's certainly given us good information about the population trajectory for the animal, but we really need long-term data to tell us about the other factors that impact on those populations. So It's essentially indefinitely, but we'll continue it as long as mallee fowl continue to be of conservation concern.
And what is the population trajectory at the moment? Is it looking hopeful?
Look, I think that the fact that we still have mallee fowl in our systems and we still have good numbers of mallee fowl is a positive thing. They are in overall across the country in a declining trajectory, but it's a gradual decline, and so that makes us believe that if we get our management right, our conservation management for this bird right, we can turn that around over time.
Oh, fingers crossed. That was NRM Senior Ecologist Craig Gillespie speaking to Anita Ward about this monitoring program for mallee fowl to try and boost the numbers of the bird that is so well known in the Mallee region, but the numbers are declining. Finally today, as they say, the show or competition must go on, and that's the case for the Mount Gambier Giant Pumpkin Competition. This year, though, it's going to be held online, despite the market where it's actually based now returning to trading post-COVID-19. Bridget Herman sat down with Mount Gambier Farmers Market Chairman Josh Praolini to find out how the biggest pumpkin will be decided.
So we're asking people to actually take photos of their pumpkins. They'll be measuring them, their circumference this time, taking photos and sending it through to us for us to weigh in from a socially responsible distance. We won't be weighing them in, we'll just be basing it on circumference, so the actual size of the pumpkin rather than the weight. So we've had to pivot a little bit there.
Pumpkin competitions are quite serious business. How are you going to ensure that people don't mess around with it a little bit? How are you going to ensure that the measuring's done correctly?
I'm just going to trust that, you know, anyone who's in a pumpkin competition is just inherently in it for the love of pumpkin growing, and they're just going to run a good, clean game. But we will verify the winners. We can get them a bit more information from them. So we'll sort of chase them up for a bit more details and some just clearer photos, I suppose, so we haven't sort of taken an extra 10, 20 centimetres at the back just to increase our pumpkin's girth.
What kind of sizes do you usually see? Are you expecting the same this year?
So, as I said, second time running it. Last year, our winner was about 55 kilos, and so we didn't actually give it a measurement around, so I'm not sure really what theirs was. I can sort of feel, but me going with my arms like this isn't very good for radio, I suppose, but 55 kilos feels pretty small. Some of the other competitions around Australia have got up to 400 kilos, but last season felt pretty bad for growing pumpkins. So from all reports, people have had a better season this year, a bit wetter, cooler summer, so I'm hoping that we get some really big sizes. I don't know, I'm feeling maybe 2 or 3 metres at the moment, really, for the winner, is what I'm feeling.
You might be a little bit hopeful there. Yeah. You can't hold the competition in person. Why are you choosing to go ahead with it? Why not just stop it for this year?
I'm thinking, actually, if anything, a lot of the COVID restrictions has meant that people have had more time at home to take care, you know. We've liked to honour the process, the time and effort, especially over the hot summer, keeping those pumpkin going. So I think it's really good. We started this back in September, you know, so we've had a long period of time to get ready for the pumpkins weighing in. COVID really didn't hit us until, you know, February, March. And so people had already invested months of time here. And I think it'd be a disservice to our customers to pull a pin on the competition at this stage. So it's really about just honouring that work people have put in. And I'm hoping, actually, because of COVID restrictions, people have had more time to just finish off those pumpkins really well.
The pumpkin competition is a part of the Mount Gambier markets, and they're starting to head back. Why are you still holding it online?
Well, part of that is just about making sure that we are socially responsible. So I think for us, protecting our customers, protecting our stallholders, you know, it's still just coming down for essential services as such, so fruit, vegetables, meats and things like that we sell. We don't want extra spectators coming in for it, so we're just really trying to minimise the people who are coming through. We want our customers there, grab their food and head off, and we're just trying to minimise that sort of crowding and milling about unnecessarily. So if restrictions continue to be lifted, the plan will be, obviously in September, we'll be giving out seeds again to run another competition, which hopefully can have that bit of a spectator sport as far as vegetable growing goes next year.
What role do farmers markets play in helping small businesses and regional communities bounce back after something like this pandemic?
I think it's a really important place, something like the Mount Gambier Farmers Market, where people who live in our community can come down, meet the actual producer. So the people who are there on the weekend, on Saturday morning, are the people who grow these things. They care for their animals, they care for their vegetables, their fruits, they care for their product. that's something you don't get in a normal supermarket, in a normal store. And so by having a place like the markets where you can come down and support local people, these are people who live in our community, go to the same sporting clubs, schools and places like that, we're keeping the money locally. And I think if anything, COVID's really highlighted to us just how much of a reliance we have on export markets. And so by being able to really just keep some of that money in our local community, support our local producers is really important. And also, I suppose it's a really good place for people who maybe have lost their jobs, interested in getting into something a bit different. It's a nice place to just start, sort of dip your toes in the water. We've had lots of little businesses that have come along when they're small scale and they've really ramped up over time to a point where they've got big supply chains now. So that's really important for us, I suppose, is to have this place available as a service to Mount Gambier, to the Limestone Coast, where producers can come, have a try, see how their products go, and move on from there.
That was Josh Praelini from the Mount Gambier Farmers Market there, saying that they are going to go ahead with the giant pumpkin competition down there in Mount Gambier, but it's going to be online. I'm interested in your success at growing big pumpkins or any vegetables, really. I think everyone seems to be able to grow a giant zucchini. And there was even that giant truffle that was found in Tasmania recently that I think just grew in and of itself. So sometimes you don't need to get in the way, just let nature run its course. But I think we might have found Australia's biggest giant pumpkin fan. Paul Latham's called in. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Cassie. How are you?
Well, thanks. What sort of a year has this one been for growing big pumpkins? Do you think we're going to see some big sizes?
It's not probably not the best year, but here in Victoria, we've had too much wet, cold weather, but even though it was stifling in some parts of the time during the fires, but generally overall it was not that fantastic. But other places, New South Wales and Tasmania, have been fairly good.
If you're new to pumpkin growing, if you've just got into it as a COVID-19 hobby or something, what's a respectable size? What's a size where you can say, yes, I grew a giant pumpkin?
Well, if you've got the Atlantic giant pumpkin seeds, you'd be able to initially easily produce a pumpkin of 40 kilos, no problems. To get it further than that, you probably need really good top-notch seeds and spend a lot of time caring for them.
What's the largest pumpkin you've grown?
247 kilos.
Wow.
That's only a baby.
That's only a baby?
Yeah.
Wow, that sounds gigantic. What would the circumference on that be?
Offhand, the circumference would be probably around about nearly 2.5 metres.
So when
around, yeah.
Okay, I thought Josh Praelini was perhaps joking when he said that that pumpkins could be 2 to 3 metres round, but that's actually not a ridiculous suggestion at all.
No, not ridiculous at all, no.
Oh, well, I hope there are some people out there, particularly Mount Gambier, but it's online, so I'm sure lots of people can enter into the competition to see if they can grow the biggest pumpkin. And thanks for the tips there, Paul.
No worries.
That was Paul Latham. He's the founding member of the Australian Giant Pumpkin and Vegetable Supporters Group. I'm sure there's probably a lot of people who probably want to join that group post COVID-19. I know I've really got my green thumb on. I wonder if Sonia Feldoff's got her green thumb on. We were talking about this the other day.
We were. I was just thinking, wasn't there a nursery rhyme where someone lived in a pumpkin?
Oh, yes.
There must be like historically really big pumpkins out there to make you think about that.
Yeah.
There?
I'm so glad they're going on. It is a good COVID-19 activity, I think.
I've never grown a big pumpkin. I grew a big zucchini.
But they taste horrible.
They do. I think big pumpkins taste horrible too, don't they? I think, you know, when you go for size, you lack something in quality at some point. You can only have one or the other.
I loathe zucchini at the best of times, so it's never been an option for me. What's coming up in the afternoon's program?
Coming up today, we're going to be talking about something that you may not have done for a very long time. Maybe not even ever, and that is the drive-in. It was a thing of the past, but 2020 drive-in experience, how will it differ or be the same as what it used to be? We don't really know exactly how many cinemas will open next week when they are allowed to, but it seems that the drive-in is attracting a lot of interest, and tonight will be night one, so what will we
I'm so excited about this. When I heard about that, I thought that's a brilliant idea and way of dealing with COVID-19.
And do you have a messy room?
I have a messy bedroom.
Okay. Mm. Now, do you find that mess just seems to, like, multiply exponentially. You turn around and then suddenly it's messy again.
Yeah, and you put so much effort into it and you don't know where it comes from.
And you might blame your partner, you might blame kids, but apparently it's time to point the finger at the universe. We'll tell you the maths and the physics of why your house gets messy.
I love this. I might get my mum to listen in. She's always complained about my room. Thanks for that, Sonia. That's all we have time for in the program today. Do keep listening to ABC Local Radio. It's coming up to 1 o'clock. Time for news.
If it's the news you need, we have it covered here on ABC South Australia and Broken Hill.